seven, six, five, four, three, two, one.
Good evening. Welcome to another evening of Clipboard Friends, featuring the absolute very best in all women's sports and HBCU athletics. This evening, let's have a moment of silence, and then we'll be ready to go. All righty. Good evening. I'm going to have Jeff open up for us this evening. We've had some tragedy in Baltimore, as you know, with the bridge collapsing. And Jeff, just bring us up today. Give us two or 3 minutes on the situation in Baltimore.
Yes, good evening, everybody. Good evening. Well, about a week now, on last Tuesday, unfortunate incident, a tanker in the Baltimore port crashed into the Francis Scott Key Bridge. That's about 53 miles north of where I live. And unfortunately, the number one thing, there was a loss of life. There were 8 construction workers on the bridge at the time. Unfortunately, we lost 6. And two survived. One was badly hurt, taken to the hospital, and another one survived without injury. That's amazing. And so just a tough situation. The Baltimore port is the 9th largest and busiest port in the nation. I mean, a lot of stuff run through there, a lot of products, and definitely automobiles. That's the biggest port that we have for automobiles, and of course the cruise lines as well. So it's been a tough situation, but as time has passed, this weekend they brought in tankers, large tankers and construction machines to clear up the debris of the bridge. It is a tedious job. It's a big, big situation up there. They have about 350 to 400 workers working 24/7, and they've actually cleared a lot thus far. It's a tough job because of the waters, very muddy waters, and a lot of debris that they have to dismantle. That debris of the bridge, they got to cut it all down. They have divers in the water, so it's a big job, and it will affect the economy, no doubt about it.
Yeah,
and so we all need to be prepared. Yeah, yes, Cliff.
Yeah, I understand that when they first got to the barge that was still stuck in the bridge, there was some hazardous waste that was still open. Do you know if they've gotten that under control? I guess that would be first priority.
Well, what happened is they had to make sure that they clear up the waste before the workers and the divers could go in. What happened is the divers have to go in and actually take pictures first, which is a tough job because it's so dark. So in order to protect the personnel that's going in the water, they had to make sure that it's safe before they can go in. As I understand today, I think I heard it mentioned today, that they did that because they needed to get those divers in the water immediately. Plus, they were also searching for the possibility of any survivors, but we know the count of the 8 construction workers. So, yeah, that was very, very important. Another thing that was critical is that they were able to signal the police that they had problems with the ship and it was going to crash into the bridge. The police, I don't know, they responded immediately and or they were there in the area quick enough to get to the bridge and stop traffic. They said it would have been a total of a minimal of 30 more cars on that bridge if they didn't stop.
Yeah. Yeah, we're going to stay on top of the story. Just one thing, and I know it's a rough question. Any rough estimate of time you think before they get that bridge back open?
Yeah, the governor of Maryland was trying to say we have to be patient on this, but it will definitely be weeks before they get all of the debris out. But listen, they've already cleared out 2 or 3 lanes that small ships and boats can pass through. That's already been done. So they are moving at a, they're not moving at a snail's pace. They're really getting this job done. But they say you're going to have to be patient because it's going to take a lot of time before they remove everything. And of course, it's going to take years before they rebuild the bridge, they put up a new bridge.
All right, Jeff. Well, thanks so much. We're going to stay on top of that story and continue to pray for Baltimore and everybody on the East Coast. We want to welcome Benita to the show from down there in the Music City. We have 5 other engaged listeners. And Dr. Kemp, we're going to come to you on this one. Louis Gossett Jr., born May 27, 1936. And we lost him March 29, 2024. This American actor, born in Coney Island, Brooklyn, New York. And boy, he was one of the first to open up the way in the movie or the acting business. He was an outstanding leading actor. And also, he won Emmy Awards. We know him in The Office of the Gentleman and so much more. Dr. Kemp, give me your thoughts. Mr. Louis Gossett Jr., a life to be celebrated.
Thanks, Dr. Gray.
Yeah.
Good evening, everyone. Yes, definitely. Our heart goes out to Louis Gossett Jr., his family, and his friends just on his passing. And he was definitely one of those outstanding actors that you knew that you definitely knew that he was going to be in either a movie, on a television show, on Broadway, that is definitely going to be good. He was just one of those greats that started out early. His high school teacher was actually one who encouraged him to audition, for a Broadway show. And he actually got the part, and pretty much the rest is history, because he pretty much appeared in so many different Broadway shows, television shows, film. But we, those of us that's actually on the show could probably remember him most for his role in Roots back in the 70s as Fiddler.
Yeah.
In drama or comedy series at the Emmy Awards. And then when he went on to play his role as the sergeant in Officer and a Gentleman. How can you forget that one, when he actually won an award for that as well? But what I found interesting back in the, just reading about him back in the 1990s and the early 2000s, it just said how he struggled with a debilitating illness. And it was actually given a prognosis. He was given a prognosis of 6 months to live from a doctor. And in 2001, he learned much of his illness was due to a toxic mold that was actually in his home. So in 2010, he announced that he had, and then he went on to announce that he had prostate cancer in 2010. And although it was caught at an early stage, he had a full recovery. And he was hospitalized for COVID-19 in Georgia, but he actually wound up passing away in a rehab center in his hometown of California.
All righty.
Mr.
Lou Gossett Jr. We got this next one. We're going to come to Steve, and then we're going to Jim talk as well, about a minute each. This one. Mr. Marvin Pence Gaye, April 2nd, 1939 to April 1st, 1984. So today is actually his birthday. This American singer, songwriter, and he helped shape the sound of Motown in the 1960s. Boy, he has so many hits. What's Going On? Heard It Through the Grapevine. He just lived a tremendous life and died tragically. And but boy, what an influence on us. Mr. Marvin Gaye. And Steve, we're going to come to you, and then we're going to come to Jim. Marvin Gaye, Steve, give us a minute.
He's one of the ones that played the soundtrack to your soul. He was a balladeer. And, you could put some Marvin Gaye on, and you could sit with a lady. I mean, he was that guy. And it's funny, he didn't want to do R&B. He wanted to do gospel. And he was really, that was his main thing. But they talked him into doing R&B, and he had some great hits with Tammy Terrell, the late, great Tammy Terrell. And he, it's so much about his life, his ups and his downs with his wife. And it's some things I could tell you that you already probably know, but I'm not going to get into that. But ironically, Cliff, the day I found out that his father killed him, I was in the store where you used to work when mm-hmm. you were in high school. Yeah. And I'll never forget it. I heard it then, and it said his father shot him. And, you know, he had a lot of ups and downs, you know, with his father that caused a rift. And it's a sad story. But, you know, I guess when you mom, it's hard watching your daddy walk around the house with panties on. And I think that caused a rift. And his mother loved him. And, you know, but, hey. It is what it is, you know, but Marvin Gaye, he was something else. He never should have left Amsterdam once he went there. He was fine when he went to Amsterdam. Not Amsterdam, New York, but when he went to Amsterdam.
Yeah, thank you so much, Steve. Jim has a special version to Marvin Gaye. Jim, fill us in some more. Got to unmute Jim. All right. We're trying to get him in because Jim has some special insight into Mr. Marvin Gaye and his family does. All right, we'll move on.
Cliff, I'm here now.
Okay, come on, Jim.
Okay, right, well, you know, Marvin Gaye actually was born on the 2nd and of April and died on the 1st. I actually knew Marvin Gaye. He was a good friend of my father's. They used to golf together. I remember one time I was out golfing. I was with my father while they were golfing, and you know, Marvin wasn't having a good day. So I said, "You're not playing well today." And he looked at me, almost wanted to say, "No S, Sherlock." But he smiled and said, "You're right, kid." He, if you look on the What's Going On album, he gave credit to James Wardell, my father. Marvin Gaye actually hung out with, Mel Farr and Lim Barney, and they actually sung background on his song. And he actually had a one-day tryout with the Lions, which didn't go too well. And one thing about Marvin Gaye, he probably has, with the only exception being Whitney Houston's national anthem rendition in 1991. In 1981, in the All-Star Game, he sung a rendition that is widely thought to be one of the better versions of the national anthem.
Absolutely. All righty. Thanks so much, Jim. Thanks so much. Marvin Gaye, y'all. What's going on? Yeah. This next one, I'm going to come to Dr. Kemp, and then we come to Jeff, and then we'll get on with sports after this. But this, my lady, is nothing but an influence. That's Dr. Maya Angelou, born April 4th, 1928. And she passed on May 28, 2014. This is American memoirist, poet, civil rights activist, and she published 7 autobiographies, 3 books of essays, and several books of poetry, and is credited with a list of plays, movies, and television shows that span over 50 years. She received dozens of awards and more than 50 honorary degrees, and a series of 7 autobiographies focused on her childhood and early adult experience. And the first, I Know Why the Caged Birds Sing. Dr. Kemp, come on with it. Dr. Maya Angelou, yes, sir.
Yes, what a phenomenal. Yeah, I just remember her because of her poetry and just everything just about her. What I found fascinating just reading up on her was that just the string of odd jobs that she had before she actually became a poet. She was a nightclub performer, a fry cook. She was actually a coordinator for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, a correspondent in Egypt and Ghana, which I thought was very, very interesting. And of course, we know her as an actress, a writer, a director, just an and of course, an author, and was also helped out during the Civil Rights Movement, worked with Dr. King, Malcolm X, did the poem for President Bill Clinton, which of course we knew of her, but I think that opened her eyes to a lot more, you know, people in America. So she is definitely a phenomenal lady.
Yeah, that's Maya Angelou. Jeff, I'll let you give a seat. You give us Dr. Angelou, Marvin Gaye, any of them. Give us your thoughts, Jeff.
Well, yes, well, Marvin Gaye, listen, I don't know if the children know, but many of them were conceived as sexual beings. So we just gonna put that out there. But you know, Maya Angelou, you know, Dr. Kemp just read off the accomplishments. It's almost too much to list. But one thing I really, really impressed my heart about her is how she influenced a number of people at many different ages. And then in particular, the girls and young ladies and women, everything about her, her style, her grace, everything about her influences our people in a big way. And that's the main thing that impressed me all the way down the line. So yeah, you got to give it up to her 100%, Cliff.
Dr. Maya Angelou, yes, sir. I'm an Oprah. You're a big influence, Oprah. All right, here we go. We have one for you. A woman of the month. Let's see if you know who she is. Toni Stone, born July 17, 1921. And she passed on November 2nd, 1996. She was an American female professional baseball player who played in the predominantly male leagues. And in 1953, she became the first woman to play as a regular on an American major level professional team. She joined the Indianapolis Clowns in the previously all-male Negro Leagues. A baseball player from her early childhood, she also played for the San Francisco Sea Lions, the New Orleans Creoles, the Indianapolis Clowns, and the Kansas City Monarchs before retiring from baseball in 1954. She was taunted at times by teammates and once being told, go home and fix your husband some biscuits, but she was undeterred. It has been widely reported that during an exhibition game in 1953, she hit a single off a fastball pitch delivered by legendary player Satchel Paige, although the claim has failed verification. So, Toni Stone, Dr. Kemp, what do you think? We got one for you this month. Toni Stone, yeah.
Dr. Bird, amazing woman. I don't know where you'd be finding these amazing women, but she could make some biscuits and throw somebody out at first, all at the same time. Just phenomenal. I would have actually thought just by her name, and I'm pretty sure a lot of the men thought just based on her name that she was probably, you know, a male, of course, since she walked on the field and just showed them what she was about. I had never heard of this amazing woman, Toni Stone, but it's just wonderful to see that she definitely played on the professional level with such greats as Satchel Paige and, you know, all of the others in the Negro League. So, and I'm glad that they definitely gave her the opportunity, you know, at that time, just to allow her to play with them.
Yeah. I'm coming to speak on her, Toni Stone. She was also a hero of Cameron and Eric. They met each other. Steve, Toni Stone. What do you think?
I'm like Marlo. I don't know how you keep finding these amazing women, but I'm glad you do because we wouldn't know. You know, stuff like this needs to be brought to the forefront. I mean, this is an amazing woman, and the thing that you have to overcome to be successful at that time, it's just, you know, it's just an accomplishment, you know, because it's not a red carpet laid out for you, you know. So what you get, you're getting it on your own. And that's just really impressive.
Yeah, 1953. Jim, I know you love baseball. Over your mic there, Jim. Toni Stone, what do you think?
Well, I'm looking at Toni Stone, and I mean, she followed Hank Aaron playing second base for the Indianapolis Clowns. Oh, yeah. I mean, you can't do better than that. And I mean, she actually told, when she started out on the West Coast, told them that she was only 17 when she was 27.
Yeah.
So, you know, she has the gumption to not only want to play sports, but do it well. And it was reported that she signed on for a staggering $12,000 for a season. Back in those days, that was unheard of. Mm-hmm. So, and a lot of money.
Yeah, paving the way. Thank you, Jim. Paving the way. We have another outstanding woman. And we have her, Toni Stone, all month, so we're coming back. We have another woman. She's a CEO. Her name is Kia Clark, K-E-I-A. C-L-A-R-K-E. She's our Woman Executive of the Month, and she's the Chief Executive Officer of the New York Liberty in the WNBA. She leads all business aspects of the Liberty organization, including the oversight of profit and losses, business operations, strategic planning, and additionally, Clark worked with stakeholders on key elements of team business, including growing the fan base, maximizing sales, fan engagement, innovation, and optimizing business performance. Miss Kia Clark, boy, Jeff, what do you think about her? She's dynamite. She's leading Liberty. They got to the finals next year.
Yeah.
But she's a business woman.
Yeah. Yep. I haven't heard of her, but I'm definitely going to research and see what's going on over there in Liberty. That's just a great accomplishment, Cliff. And I think we need to, I want to recommend that we have a show about your archives, because you're the only one who has access to these archives.
Hey, we're opening all up. We love highlighting our women, and there's some great stories out here. Jim, Miss Pia, what do you think? Your talk.
I don't know how you find these people, but you know, she, just reading about her, she's been recognized by just about everybody. Crane's Business, Sports Illustrated, Metro Women Inspiration, Adweek, UNET, CNBC. She's been everybody.
Okay.
So, you know, I like my aces, but I'm a cheer for the Liberty just because she's a part of it.
Behind the scenes. Just like last month, there's more than April of the NBA. Always making it happen. You're right. Now, we have another story. We hate to have to bring it, but it's real. This is March Madness. 64 teams in the women, 68 men. We're supposed to be talking about now Division I, and that's what we're talking about. But a few weeks ago, in the big dance, NCAA Division I, the Utah women's basketball team were playing in Spokane, Washington. Couldn't get a hotel room, so they end up staying in Coeur, C-O-E-U-R, Aline, Idaho. They said it was about 30 or 40 miles from where they were playing. But the players had some racist, straightforward group that drove by in a truck, called them the N-word, drove back by to the hotel, and continued to taunt them. There were white supremacists in Idaho. I'm not saying the whole state of Idaho is like that. But these players, they moved them in that region very quickly from that hotel. They found a hotel close to Spokane, Washington. And I just think it's a shame today that we still have to put up with this.